This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So my basic idea is, let's push renewables as far as we can, but let's not bet the farm on them.
If you had a functional magic wand, wouldn't you use it to reverse climate change? A quick flick of your wrist and presto change-o, our troubles would be over. But as our guest this week on Sea Change Radio, David Hart, rightly points out, that's not how the world works. Hart, a professor at George Mason University and a senior fellow at the Information, Technology, and Innovation Foundation, summarizes his recent report on the need to avoid overly optimistic, simplistic solutions to climate change, or what he calls magical thinking. He argues that environmentalists and science deniers may both be guilty of this enchanting oversimplification, and posits that instead we need to devise complex strategies to address the multifaceted dilemma that is climate change. I'm joined now by David Hart. He's a professor at George Mason University, and he is also the director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy there. And he's also a senior fellow at the ITF, the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. David, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
Well, you wrote an important piece that was posted on ITIF's website that caught my eye, and I wanted to discuss it with you and have you summarize it for our listeners if you can. It's entitled, Rescuing the Low Carbon Energy Transition from Magical Thinking. Now, we've had other guests on the show, like I'm thinking of Steve Almond, the writer who wrote a piece about groupthink after 9/11 in terms of magical thinking. But what do you mean here when we're applying magical thinking to something like transitioning from a fossil fuel economy to a low carbon energy future?
Well, what I mean is the idea that people would like the transition to go a certain way. For instance, they hope that the government can stay out of it and science can do all the work. Or they may hope that renewables can provide all the energy that we need. And what worries me about that is that these approaches aren't based on a realistic assessment of what the challenge is, which is complicated and uncertain. And it's not exactly clear how we're going to make it through the transition. So my belief is we're going to need more technological options. And my concern is that these advocates of magical thinking aren't serious enough about the new technologies that we're going to need.
And you've isolated four forms of magical thinking about energy transition. Why don't you summarize those first for our listeners?
Sure. So the first one is a little bit unique. These are the people who don't believe that climate change is happening, or they believe that it isn't man-made, or they believe that it isn't harmful. And this is a special group because they don't believe that there should be any kind of energy transition. So I would set them aside. I considered it magical thinking because they're ignoring the strong consensus among scientists and many, many forms of evidence that show that climate change is happening, it is man-made, and it is harmful. So that's a separate kind of special group. Then we have three ways of thinking about the transition where everyone agrees that climate change is happening and that we need to make a transition in order to limit its most dangerous effects. The first group, we can broadly call it the eco-right. So these are conservative thinkers who accept the science of climate change, and their policy proposal is to encourage scientists to do a lot more research, which is a great idea. We need scientists doing research, but scientific research alone is not going to change the energy markets. The energy markets are very big, and energy is very cheap, and it's going to be difficult to get consumers to buy new forms of energy without a whole lot of additional government steps beyond simply supporting research. So the magical thinking there is sort of the scientific breakthrough will provide an answer, and I just don't think that's realistic. The second form I call preemptive, sort of premature triumphalism. This is the view that we have the technologies that we need. We just need to get them out there. And there's two broad groups within this category. One are the folks who think that nuclear power is the answer, and we have effective nuclear power systems that can simply be deployed on a large scale. And the biggest challenge here is that nuclear power is very expensive, and the waste problem hasn't been solved. And we're going to need, I think, advanced forms of nuclear to contribute to the energy transition. The other group within this category are the group that think we can get to 100% renewable power. And I think these are interesting models, but I don't think that they can be realized in practice. So the figure that I use in the paper is within the plan presented by Mark Jacobson for the United States. So his proposal to shift the U.S. to an entirely renewable generated power system would require 156,000 offshore wind turbines by 2050. So that's 35 years away. And at the moment, the U.S. is just about to commission its first offshore wind farm, about 5 wind turbines off the coast of Rhode Island. So to go from 5 to 156,000 in 35 years seems like a stretch. And that's true for a number of other technologies that he proposes to expand. So while it might be possible, it doesn't seem like you would want to place the whole planet's fate on that kind of a plan. A lot of obstacles can emerge, not just technical obstacles, but also public acceptance obstacles. It's been very difficult to site offshore wind farms, in part because the homeowners near the shore opposed them. So I just think it's an extremely risky proposition. And in fact, that proposal reminds me a bit of the nuclear advocates from the 1950s and 60s who said that nuclear power would be too cheap to meter. And they also ran into public acceptance roadblocks, and nuclear power stalled out. It currently provides about 20% of the U.S. electricity, but it's been stuck at that level for a long time. So that's two camps. First, the people who think we just need a science push. Second, the people who think the technology is already here, whether it's nuclear power or renewables. And then the third group that I discuss are the mainstream economists who believe that we should place a price on carbon, and that will pretty much take care of the problem. And there, the magical thinking is that the political system is going to accept a carbon price that is high enough to drive a technology change of the sort that we need. There are some small steps that have been taken towards placing a price on carbon, and there may be further progress at the state level, but I think the odds of a national carbon tax are very low, and it's a simple reason. It's because the public likes cheap energy. So my thinking about that proposal is that if research, development, demonstration, and deployment policies can help bring the price of alternatives down, then a carbon price can be more easily accepted because it's not going to drive costs up as much as it would if the alternatives were very expensive. So those are my four categories.
So, David, the first one, climate change denialism, it's unique to the United States, I think it's fair to say. We don't have a large climate change denial movement happening on any significant scale elsewhere. I'm curious why you included it in the four. Is there overlap between climate change denialism and some of this other magical thinking, whether it be science push or premature triumphalism, et cetera?
Yeah, I don't think there's an overlap. The reason I include it is because if we neglect it, we don't understand the full political context in the U.S. and the importance of everybody who accepts the that climate change is really happening to get together. Because this climate change denial, while it may be unique to the U.S., it isn't small and it isn't weak. It's a very powerful point of view. It dominates most of the Republican Party. And that's the reason why everybody else needs to get together.
Let me postulate one theory why there is some overlap. When I was reading it, I thought of laziness as kind of the overlap. I had a discussion with a friend about the Middle East once. And I was like, so what do you think is the solution? He was like, electric cars, and then everybody will stop being dependent on oil and the Arab nations won't have this much power, et cetera. It's just a nice, simple solution. And I think that's kind of the overlap between climate change denialism and some of these very simple silver bullet fixes that you are outlining in the piece.
I think that's a fair point. I also think that it's very difficult for people to change their minds, and they would tend to focus on a solution that's consistent with their preconceived beliefs, whether it's a carbon tax for economists or renewables only for environmentalists. It's a natural human thing, and I'm sure I could be accused of some of the same arguments. So I do think there is a desire to make as minimal adjustment in your belief system as possible.
How does the climate change exist, but man is maybe not causing it? How would that be part of your analysis here?
Well, I guess I lump them all together. So three pieces. One, you could deny that climate change isn't happening. You could deny that it's man-made, or you could deny that it's harmful. So there are people who believe that it's going to be helpful. But I guess I would put them all together in the sense that regardless of which of those views you hold, you don't believe that a transition has to occur. So if you don't think it's human caused, then it's really nothing that humans could do about it. If it's caused by, you know, something astronomical, our relationship with the sun or something else, I'm not sure that they have any plausible scientific argument about it, just that they accept the observation and they don't accept the theory. So again, I think it's just easier to keep your prior beliefs consistent. Life is what you make it. That's what the people say. If I can't make it through tomorrow, I better make it through today.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor David Hart. So, David, let's turn to the science push argument. Let me quote from your article in the on the ITIF site. Sprinkling loads of fairy dust in the form of research grants and development contracts may make scientists happy, but it will not by itself turn our fossil fuel frog into a low carbon prince. And then you go on to quote some of the scientists and people in the environmental community like Freeman Dyson and Jim Manzi, who believe that we have the technology now and all we got to do is invest in it and make it a reality. Where do you see the flaw in this and why is that detrimental?
I think it's good to support new ideas and to encourage scientists to explore, you know, what nature may have to offer that we haven't discovered yet. The challenge is that it's a long ways from the lab to the power plant or to the transportation system. And to go from a concept that a scientist might prove in his lab to an actual functioning system that provides energy or provides some kind of a service to people at a price that they can afford, usually takes thousands times additional investment. It takes a lot of engineering. It takes engagement with users to find out, you know, what their needs are. So just to fund scientists to prove things in labs is going to, you know, help. It may expand knowledge, but it won't necessarily solve human needs. That requires connection with companies, connection with users, and usually a lot more investment.
And let's talk about how fracking and investment informed your piece. That was an investment into a technology where there was already huge adoption of fossil fuels. So you weren't starting with a clean slate by any means, although the technology took decades and a lot of money to develop.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a little known fact that government support did help the development of fracking, both kind of the computer models that allow people to find these reservoirs and figure out how to get to them, and also the physical technologies that allow the gas to be extracted. But it wasn't just federal investment, and it wasn't just in, you know, university researchers. Some of it came through support of companies, and then the companies put a lot of their own money into it. And as you mentioned, once they saw the opportunity here, then they had a tremendous market incentive to, you know, bring it to, you know, into actual operation, which required a lot more refinement of the technology and bringing down the costs, and you know, many years, if not decades, to bring it to full scale. So the research funding was important, but it was just the first step.
And let's turn to premature triumphalism. You mentioned Stanford engineer Mark Jacobson, how he had a very rosy picture of wind turbines being able to supplant our current fossil fuel infrastructure, but we have so many technologies out there that are very promising, and critics will look at the cost differences, saying it's just at low gas prices, solar and wind can't compete. But once these technologies really start to boom, won't those costs become much more competitive with cheaper fossil fuels? And then lastly, we look at the intermittency issues with some of these renewables and how storage technology is kind of lagged behind. But when that becomes a reality, and it seems like, and a lot of environmentalists like to quote, as you mentioned, Moore's Law, that the storage capacity is going to be doubling, tripling, quadrupling in the years ahead, that will give us a much more even footing to be able to compare fossil fuels to renewables on an apples-to-apples basis. But you don't necessarily see it that way.
No, I don't. And I'm really enthusiastic about renewables. The price decreases have been quite extraordinary in the last few years. And I'm very hopeful that they'll keep up. But I don't think that renewables can get us to the kind of targets that were set in Paris. So 80% reduction in carbon dioxide emissions. And you mentioned a number of the reasons. Partly it's the intermittency of renewables. Their land footprint is also very large. So you need a lot of space if you're going to generate a lot of power. And because they're intermittent, you have to build a lot more capacity than you otherwise would if you have a plant that can operate at 100% of the time, or 90% as most fossil fuel plants can. You have to build, you know, quite a bit more solar or wind capacity to match that generation. And then, as you mentioned, you also need storage, which at this point isn't economical. And it's very complicated. The intermittency varies over days, it varies over seasons, and so the storage piece is quite complex. And it's not clear that even if we have cheap lithium-ion batteries, which are the batteries in most electronics and which are increasingly being seen as a good opportunity for application in the power sector, even if we have these kinds of batteries that are cheap, it's not really going to solve the intermittency problem because they're just not big enough and they can't discharge enough and they don't last long enough at this point. So I think we're going to need some new storage technologies that are complementary with renewables. And similarly, you mentioned smart grid, which is the application of information technology to the electricity system. Really complicated to manage all these different sources with intermittency. So I think we have a long ways to go to make renewables as useful as they're going to be. They're going to get more useful. They're going to get cheaper. But I don't think we should base our whole strategy on that premise. And we're going to need some other kinds of power sources. It's also possible that they'll run into roadblocks, as I mentioned, siting roadblocks to build on the scale that we need, cost roadblocks, even if the price of solar modules comes down, the rest of the system doesn't necessarily come down in price as quickly. So my basic idea is let's push renewables as far as we can, but let's not bet the farm on them.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor David Hart. So what was the inspiration to embarking on this research project, David? And on one hand, people may come away from it thinking, well, we're really screwed. And this magical thinking that we've gone down, and you've divided it up well, is really putting us on the wrong path. But there's also a glass half full lens that one could look through. Why don't you walk us back to the genesis of the project and how you see it informing long-term solutions for the energy grid for the world?
Absolutely. So I would hate for people to read the paper and walk away hopeless. That's not my intention, and that's not my view. I think there is a hope, and the world has begun to take some important steps, and the U.S. has begun to take some important steps. Our CO2 emissions are declining, and our CO2 emissions per unit of economic growth are declining even faster. So those are important steps. But we need to have a kind of long-term pathway in mind, and to be working on multiple timescales at once. And what worries me at the moment is that people aren't thinking about the long-term, although they may say they are. I don't think they're thinking about the options that we're going to need in 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road, when we have to really make more difficult decisions about what kind of cars we're going to drive, about really getting our power system to very low levels of carbon emissions. So the way I think about it is we have some options for the short term, and we're pursuing them, but we need our more options for the longer term. And to expect that we're going to run into roadblocks, and to in some ways expect the unexpected. So some of these investments are like insurance policies, and we don't want to put all of our chips on any one technology, whether it's renewables, whether it's nuclear, whether it's energy efficiency. But we want to get a mix, and that's the way energy systems are. They're always mixed. And if we have enough options, we'll be able to build the kind of mix that we need. So I see it as a hopeful enterprise, and I see that there are a variety of points of views that might come together around this theme of innovation. So I hope that it will lead to building a broader coalition around that idea.
So would it be fair to summarize that magical thinking in a vacuum can be detrimental, but if we can combine multiple magical thinking solutions, that may not be such a bad way to approach it?
Yeah, maybe we need to change the metaphors here, and go to the old tried and true one of the blind man and the elephant. I think each of these perspectives has something valuable to offer, and we need to take the best of each and combine them.
I don't know the metaphor of the blind man and the elephant.
The blind man and the elephant is, each blind person is feeling a different part of the elephant, describing a different beast. So one is describing the trunk, one is describing the feet, one is describing the flank, and they all think each is describing this incredible beast, but none of them has the full perspective of what it looks like when you put it together.
I see. I know the white elephant.
No, I'm working on white elephants, but that's a different project.
Gotcha.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor David Hart. So let's turn to what we should place our hope in. If we just looked at each one of these things in a vacuum, I think we would be pretty depressed. But I don't think you see it that way after reading your piece.
No, I don't. And I guess another way to look at this is that each of these points of view, setting aside the climate change denial people, each one of these points of view has an important insight. And we need to combine these insights into a broader package of activities that the policymakers can follow.
And where do you think is a good place to start in terms of finding the proper mix? You mentioned the Paris Agreement. What will get us to meeting those 80% type targets that Paris laid out?
I mean, I think we need to continue to support renewables, but we need to drive them to get their costs down. So one of the challenges of our current policy for solar in particular is that we have a fixed subsidy. There's a 30% federal tax incentive. And at a certain point, that just becomes a subsidy. There's no incentive to get below 30%. So we need a mechanism from the tax perspective to subsidize new technologies for a while, but then to wean them off of the subsidy. So, and we see that happening with wind. The wind tax credit is supposed to go away now in the next 2 or 3 years. So that's part of it, is to have a more effective tax regime. I think one easy place to start is to expand our research and development spending. So this would support the science push point of view. Along with the climate agreement in Paris, there was an agreement called Mission Innovation, in which most of the leading scientific and technology supporting countries agreed to double their public investment in R&D. And along with that, a group of private investors led by Bill Gates said that they would help take these technologies out of the lab and support them with venture capital. So the U.S. Has put forward, the Obama administration has put forward a plan to go from about $6 billion in spending in the past fiscal year to $12 billion in spending in 2021. And so I think that's a relatively low-cost place to start, but we ought to, along with that, improve the way the Department of Energy does business to connect it more effectively with the private sector, to open it up, open up our national lab systems. So I think there's both a spending component and a reform component that would help us move down the pathway towards improving our technologies.
So at the end of the piece, David, you list a lot of the key items that you think will be vital for a solution to a low carbon energy future. If you were advising the president right now and he wanted 3 or 4 bullet points, which ones would you pull out of that list?
Yeah, so I would start with a principle, which is that we should make innovation a driving force for all of our policy instruments. So for instance, in the area of tax incentives, we need tax incentives that help drive innovation and that don't just subsidize incumbent industry, whether it's the incumbent solar industry or the incumbent fossil fuel industry. We need regulations that will help drive innovation and not simply impose costs on existing industries. So I would say that that's the biggest concept there. We have a lot of different tools, and we just need to design them more effectively to drive innovation. And then we also need public investment. Some of that public investment is long-term science-based investment, but a lot of it needs to be shared investment with industry. So I would emphasize co-investment between the private sector and the public sector to try to reduce the risks of technologies that are sort of in the in-between stage. They're not in the lab stage, but they're not in the market yet. And so there's a lot of risk from the private perspective, but there's a public benefit from the public perspective. And we need more effective partnership programs that will help move those technologies from the concept stage into the market. And then we want to, as I mentioned earlier, wean them off the public support so that they can become fully integrated into the market.
He's a professor at George Mason University, David Hart. David, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Terrence Blanchard, Eric Clapton, and Herbie Hancock. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.